Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Subversive 70s by Michael Hart, narrated by Tom Parks. Chapter 1. Introduction. The Subversive 70s. That we have had nothing to do with terrorism is obvious. That we have been subversive is equally obvious. Between these two truths lies the key issue at stake in our trial. Militants of Autonomia, awaiting trial in Rebibbia Prison, Rome, 1983. The 1970s was a decade of subversives. Politicians and their generals, police chiefs and secret service agents, conservative journalists and intellectuals saw subversives everywhere, challenging authority, laying siege to the established order, undermining the time-honored way of life. This mentality was so flexible, it could designate as subversive indigenous peasant armies and gay liberation organizations, self-organized industrial workers, and anti-nuclear activists, revolutionary feminists, and black liberation militants. Every corner of the left was fertile ground for subversive elements, which the forces of order had to root out and destroy, a project they pursued with zeal and brutality. The battle against subversives in the 1970s legitimated extreme forms of repression and opened the counterinsurgency playbook for use against a range of domestic enemies. Police and military repression of the left rose to extreme levels and took a wide variety of forms with varying degrees of lethal and non-lethal force, including disinformation campaigns, surveillance, infiltration, extra-legal incarceration, targeted assassinations, mass disappearances, and torture. It is tempting, given all the mystifications it evokes and the violence it justifies, simply to discard the term subversive. But it is more useful to approach the term from the other side and embrace it. After all, those engaged in the progressive and revolutionary movements of the 1970s were in fact, and understood themselves to be, subversives. Instead of working within the system, they aimed to undermine the bases of established authorities and transform the fundamental structures of society. These activists were not satisfied with limited social and political reforms or partial alleviation of the suffering and exploitation of the subordinated, if this meant leaving the foundations of the established order intact. Liberation was the core principle that guided a wide spectrum of movements, from women's liberation and the liberation of colonized peoples, to black liberation, gay liberation, and proletarian liberation. Subversion and liberation thus go hand in hand, and only together can they make another world, a better world, possible. I propose to return to the subversive 70s then, not from the perspective of those in power desperately clinging to the established order, but rather from that of those striving to change it. Many books have been written, and many more are still needed, about the regimes of domination that emerged in the 1970s. Brutal military dictatorships in Latin America, Turkey, and South Korea. The birth of neoliberalism, along with the attack on labor unions and the dismantling of welfare structures. The oppressive authority of state socialisms, and much more. This book is about the other side. In the following chapters, I select and analyze social and political movements that are subversive in a double sense. They seek to dismantle and overthrow the social structures of domination, while at the same time constructing the basis for liberation. These are, in fact, the ones most relevant for our contemporary political situation, in part because they challenged political and economic structures that were emerging at the time and still rule over us today. The subversive 70s constitute a first essay to confront our current conjecture, a first test of the terrain. They offer us, in other words, not only initial analyses of today's structures of economic and political domination, and not only effective forms of critique and resistance against them, but also experiments with alternative social and political relations on the path to liberation. The decade when nothing happened. Many of the progressive and revolutionary projects of the 70s remain today relatively unknown. They are often obscured or discounted in relation to conventional images of the politics of the 1960s. Clarifying and repositioning the relation between the two decades, then, is a prerequisite for appreciating the political accomplishments of the 70s and revealing their importance for us today. Most standard accounts cast the progressive and revolutionary movements of the 60s in a brilliant and rosy light. Iconic images that celebrate the decade's struggles for peace, justice, and freedom are shared touchstones of cultural memory. Students occupying courtyards of the Sorbonne and administrative buildings at Columbia University. New leaders declaring independence in Algeria, Kenya, and other former colonies. Black marchers in Selma, all dressed in their Sunday best, maintaining their solemn poise and commitment to nonviolence, even under brutal police attack. Mexican student demonstrators at Tlatelolco, massacred by government snipers. Prague protesters facing off with Soviet tanks. Young people in the streets across the world protesting the U.S. war in Vietnam. These are some of the snapshots in a collective photo album. Such representations, as many authors have rightly demonstrated, are often sanitized to white out the most radical and troubling elements of the global 60s. One consequence of such distortions is to obscure the political developments of the subsequent years. Todd Gitlin, for example, after having celebrated progressive U.S. political culture in the 60s as an era of innocence and hope, laments that by the end of the decade, it all came to an end. By the early 70s, he claims, the upheaval was over, as mysteriously as it had appeared, and as worldwide. The powerful tide of revolution that flooded the 60s, Gitlin continues, now swept back out just as ferociously. To maintain that nothing happened in the 1970s, however, requires strategic blindness. To some extent, that blindness has to do with how. Many of the most prominent movements of the 60s, industrial workers' movements, feminists, national liberation and anti-imperialist struggles, anti-racist movements, student and youth rebellions, indigenous struggles, continued in the 70s, in many cases in greater numbers and with greater intensity than before. The fact that they could become invisible, at least for some, was due to the fact that they took on very different characteristics, radically altered forms of organization, and new objectives, which did not fit into acceptable narratives. Nanni Balestrini and Primo Moroni, for example, referring to 1968 and 1977, the signal dates of movement activity in Italy, maintain that whereas dominant society could comprehend and digest, so to speak, the forms of protest that characterized the 60s, the militancy of the 70s proved indigestible. This is why, they maintain, we have the official versions of good old 68 and bad 77. In fact, whereas 68 was recuperated, 77 was annihilated. The 70s movements were wiped from memory then, in part because they had become unrecognizable from, or politically unacceptable to, the official narrative. The strategic blindness is even more apparent, however, regarding who, because the 70s landscape of progressive and revolutionary activity included movements by populations that previously had not been active or had not been widely recognized, notably feminist struggles, gay liberation movements, movements of the poor and unemployed, indigenous struggles, and various racial and ethnic rebellions. The media says that nothing happened in the 70s, Bernice Johnson Reagan told a feminist audience at the 1981 West Coast Women's Music Festival in San Francisco. And most of us get up on stage and we talk as if that in fact is the case, and it's a lie. The only way it will be true is if you believe them and do not take the next step. As if hidden by an invisibility cloak or screened from view by an optical filter, the intense political activity that emerged in the 70s remains unseen from the dominant perspective. Nothing to see here, move along. The first challenge, then, is simply to remove the blinders and see the 70s, to take stock of the intense and widespread political activity that actually took place. The decade when everything went wrong. A more significant challenge to interpreting the 70s is posed by the good 60s/bad 70s paradigm, whereby radical and revolutionary activity did continue, but took on increasingly dark and destructive characteristics. Two influential histories of the era, for example, use their subtitles to designate the decline and degeneration from one period to the next. The subtitle of Hervé Amon and Patrick Rotman's two-volume set contrasts The Years of Dreams, 1958 to 1968, and The Years of Powder, meaning gunpowder, 1968 to 1975. And the subtitle of Todd Gitlin's book distinguishes The Years of Hope, the early and mid-1960s, from The Days of Rage, roughly after 1968. In both histories, the image of youthful innocence and nonviolence in the former period, with its hope and dreams, is contrasted with the image of destructiveness in the latter. The periodizations do not neatly line up, of course, but a shared standard view is that after the late 1960s, the left was destroyed, or even worse, destroyed itself. There are several versions of this argument. Each identifies a different cause of the destruction, and each has a kernel of truth, which is what makes this argument so challenging. One version of what went wrong focuses on the internal conflicts, and especially the erosion of unity on the left. Progressive and revolutionary organizations were profoundly shaken in the 70s by internal challenges to the hierarchies that constituted them. This was the era in which feminists refused to continue to serve, in Shulamith Firestone's memorable phrase, as the ladies' auxiliaries of the left, contesting the patriarchal structures and sexist attitudes within student, labor, and anti-racist movements. Black workers rebelled against white-dominated union hierarchies. Feminists of color and lesbians challenged racial and sexuality hierarchies and exclusions within feminist movements. Black nationalists challenged the racism of white allies. Gay liberation movements and the Stonewall Generation decried the homophobia of the left. Third world militants criticized the provincialism and complicity of first world activists, and much, much more. To many, it seemed the left was imploding, tearing itself apart through separatism and identity politics. To others, of course, this reckoning was long overdue, and any nostalgia for unity was just a means to mask subordination. It was essential to reveal hierarchies within the movements themselves, they maintained, and understand that liberation projects must attack multiple forms of domination, defined by race, gender, sexuality, class, and more, both inside and outside the left. Here, one can easily recognize the positive effects of internal conflicts and an example of the demand for multiplicity in action. A second version of the everything went wrong argument, as well as the good 60s/bad 70s paradigm, highlights the numerous defeats the left suffered in the 70s. A long list comes quickly to mind. The 1973 U.S.-supported coup d'état in Chile dashed the global hopes that had been raised by Salvador Allende's election. Military dictatorships in Brazil, Bolivia, Uruguay, and Argentina, plus military coups d'état in Thailand, 1976, and Turkey, 1980, strangled all forms of leftist political action and expression. Vibrant social movements, such as the Italian extra-parliamentary left and the South African Black Consciousness Movement, were defeated by state repression and mass arrests. The industrial labor movement, too, suffered pivotal, generation-defining defeats with mass firings of workers. These extended into the next decade, culminating in, for example, the 1980 Fiat strike in Turin, the 1981 U.S. air controller strike, and the 1984 to 1985 UK miner strike. These defeats, each more tragic than the last, piled up like so many mangled vehicles in a highway accident. We certainly do have to face clearly every defeat and its terrible consequences. But simply focusing on victory or defeat misses what is most politically significant and useful. Robin D.G. Kelly rightly laments that, too often, our standards for evaluating social movements pivot around whether or not they succeeded in realizing their visions, rather than on the merits or power of the visions themselves. Those visions remain alive and strong beyond defeat. The long history of revolutionary movements teaches us that a defeat, however devastating, is never an end point. Future projects of liberation begin from where it ended, taking its achievements and the power of its vision as the point of departure for new struggles. A third version of the "everything went wrong" argument highlights the political violence of the 70s, sometimes with the misleading assumption that the 60s were characterized by peaceful, nonviolent protest. This is a complicated story that does not allow for easy, unqualified political judgments. In this version of the good 60s/bad 70s paradigm, the left lost its way and destroyed itself through the violent actions of organizations that conducted clandestine armed struggle, including the Red Brigades, the Japanese Red Army, Germany's Red Army faction, Black September, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Provisional Irish Republican Army, the Montoneros, and numerous other such militarized formations. Some of these groups committed horrifying acts that should unequivocally be condemned morally and politically, and in the course of the book, I will offer some analyses and critique of them. Before engaging such judgments, though, one must first contend with the context of extreme repression in which these groups operated. Although state suppression of leftist political activism in the 1960s had not been peaceful, far from it, in the 1970s, the intensity of state and police violence, sometimes in conjunction with fascists, death squads, and other right-wing groups, rose exponentially. Ever greater numbers of demonstrators were beaten and shot. Counterintelligence schemes proliferated, along with unfounded legal proceedings against activists and unjustified imprisonment. Second, one must distinguish among different modes of deploying weapons and different strategies of self-defense, some of which, I will argue, were appropriate and necessary for protecting innovative democratic political movements. In particular, some organizations developed a dual strategy, by which they were able to defend the movements from repression while developing democratic social projects. Finally, focusing on armed struggle must not be allowed to eclipse other, often more significant political movements that did not deploy weapons. The spectacular and frequently tragic robberies, bombings, kidnappings, and assassinations garnered extraordinary attention at the time, and still today occupy an outsized position in historical memory, vastly disproportionate to the small numbers of militants involved in these groups. I will thus try to quarantine discussions of armed struggle, civil war, and terrorism toward the end of the book, in order elsewhere to allow for undivided attention on other movements. The 1970s are undoubtedly a troubling decade that defies simple, unqualified judgments. Jaime Pensado and Enrique Ochoa, thinking primarily about Mexico, note the dual nature of what they, too, call the subversive 70s. On one hand, the emergence of a distinct spirit of utopia and revolution, and, on the other, a novel rhythm of despair and political violence. Such divided, ambivalent, even contradictory assessments of the 1970s are probably necessary. What then, asks Danberger, in line with Pensado and Ochoa, are we to make of the 1970s? It was a deeply ambivalent and contentious moment, simultaneously moving in multiple directions. I will highlight these characteristics in the following chapters, but it is worth noting from the outset that the complexities and the ambivalence of the 70s should be not lamented, but recognized as a virtue. Even in such a fraught political context, facing unresolvable problems and the threat of brutal repression, these movements were able to navigate through the dangers and forward projects of liberation. Concepts generated in the movements. The array of progressive and revolutionary movements across the globe in the 70s was extraordinarily varied, and each should be appreciated and evaluated in its own singular context. And yet, if one takes a step back to view the broad international landscape, some coherent patterns emerge, which are particularly evident in the concepts that are produced by and circulate among the movements. I propose to interpret the movements in terms of their concepts. But by that, I am not referring primarily to what intellectuals had to say about them. We need to cast aside the false assumption of a division of labor, by which intellectuals think and activists act, and to recognize the value of theorizing advanced collectively in the movements themselves. Part of the work of political movements, especially revolutionary ones, in fact, is to invent concepts. Autonomy is one concept that characterized the aspirations of a wide range of progressive and revolutionary movements of the 70s. Radical industrial workers, for instance, while taking control of their own struggles, declared their autonomy not only from the factory bosses, but also from the leadership and dictation of the dominant unions. Industrial workers in a range of national contexts created collective decision-making structures to determine themselves when to begin a strike and when to end it, whether to occupy a factory and how to manage it, and even when to take up arms to defend themselves. The early 1970s were a high point of industrial class struggle in many countries in terms of both the intensity and number of strikes. The claim to autonomy was also a strong component of the many movements that employed the strategy of encampment, designed in most cases to block large infrastructure projects, an airport, a military base, or a nuclear reactor, by occupying the land, for months in some cases, and for years or even over a decade in others. Each encampment effectively declared autonomy from the state and refused the state's authority to make unilateral decisions over these infrastructure projects. Autonomy in all these cases indicated not only a refusal of authority, but also a refusal of structures of representation, claiming decision-making power for those involved regarding the most important issues affecting their lives. Multiplicity is another conceptual touchstone that runs through the movements, emerging especially clearly from feminist debates. A precondition for the political conception of multiplicity was the recognition, increasingly widespread by the middle of the decade, that the centrality of industrial workers in the revolutionary struggle had come to an end. This was not the end of class struggle or its importance, of course, but the end of the assumed priority of industrial workers and the belief that a workers' vanguard could lead and unify the revolutionary movement as a whole. This complex and contrasting development of the peak of industrial workers' power and the end of their centrality in revolutionary movement will be explored in depth in Part 3. What emerged instead were parallel conceptions of multiplicity, an analysis of power, and a strategic proposal. Activists and theorists in the 70s formulated an analysis of power characterized by intersecting identities and multiple structures of domination, capitalist, racial, imperialist, and patriarchal, which anticipated in some respects the notion of intersectionality that developed a decade later. Correspondingly, they forwarded a strategic proposal that feminist, anti-racist, anti-imperialist, and anti-capitalist struggles be articulated together without priority among them. Similar proposals of strategic multiplicity were also formulated in multiracial political projects, under the banner of people of color in the United States, for instance, and within the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa. In these cases, too, the strategic multiplicity can only function, as we will note next, so long as none of its component parts is given priority over the others. Democracy is a third concept that resonated widely in the struggles. The notions of revolutionary democracy that proliferated not only stood opposed to authoritarian government and capitalist control, but also rejected the established structures of liberal democratic regimes. In summary terms, one could say that this democracy prioritizes participation over representation. Universal participation in political decision-making, rather than existing schemes of representation that leave power in the hands of the few. Revolutionary movements experimented with investing power in a vast array of commission structures so as to institutionalize democratic participation. Work commissions in factories, rural village commissions, neighborhood commissions, and more. And, in some cases, movements found effective means to scale up local decision-making structures to the metropolitan and national levels. Liberation, finally, may be the concept that links together all the others and serves as the master concept for the era. Activists were convinced that, through organized struggle, it was possible to change everything, to reinvent society from the ground up. Liberation is not just emancipation, that is, releasing people from their chains in order to participate in the existing society. Liberation requires, in addition, a radical transformation of that society, overturning its structures of domination and creating new institutions that foster freedom. But even that is not enough, because for liberation, not only the structures, but also the subjects must change, initiating a process of collective, subjective transformation. The 70s may be the last period in which numerous large-scale social and political movements had the audacity and confidence to aim unequivocally at liberation and put in practice the means to achieve it. I know that these concepts presented so briefly remain at an abstract, theoretical level. Investigations of the movements in the following chapters, however, will elaborate them in more specific and concrete terms, and in turn, the concepts will guide my analysis of the political developments. This conceptual approach is particularly appropriate, as I said, because the activists themselves were theorizing collectively, generating these and other concepts as beacons to guide and understand their own struggles. History of the present. What most significantly divides the progressive and revolutionary movements of the 70s from those of the 60s are their different relations to the present. Simplifying a great deal, the 60s were a crucial historical turning point that marked the end of an era. The coincidence and accumulation of struggles in that decade, sometimes referred to as the Global 1968, including anti-colonial and anti-imperialist struggles, revolts against state socialist regimes, insurgencies against racial domination, industrial worker rebellions against factory discipline, and more, made the ruling global framework of power, as well as disciplinary regimes in each country, increasingly ungovernable, and precipitated a series of social, economic, and political crises in the early 1970s. We can certainly learn from the movements of the 60s then, both those that were victorious and those that were vanquished. But fundamentally, they belong to a past world, not ours. The 1970s, in contrast, mark the beginning of our time. It was a decade of great tectonic shifts in the structures and mechanisms that rule the social order, which scholars have tried to capture from a variety of angles with various terms.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?